out your pet spider named Big Bob or your monkey named Marcel, because this is Film Shake. I'm Jordan.
And this is Nick.
And we are the 90s Movies Podcast. Welcome back for episode 52. We're here to talk about Arachnophobia from 1990, and we have a double feature, that movie along with Outbreak from 1995.
Yes, it's an episode of epidemic proportions.
Nice. So, Nick, who do you think would win in a fight between the Outbreak monkey and the general spider from Arachnophobia?
Oh, man, it's weird because if we're going by, like, Ebola rules, if that monkey has Ebola and bites the spider, even if the spider is able to kill Marcel with a poisonous bite, it could transmit Ebola to the spider. So the spider would be like, oh, I'm a badass. I just killed that stupid damn monkey. What a moron. And then, you know, all of a sudden he's bleeding from the eyes and vomiting and diarrheaing out blood, like having spider blood diarrhea. And then he's dead. So it's like a draw. That's what I think.
I feel like Marcel wins in either situation here. Like, he can either, I guess, like, cough on the spider. And if, I don't know if the spider could ingest the disease in that way once it becomes, you know, airborne. It doesn't become airborne until later, right? So that's out. But he could just lick the spider in its fangs or something, right?
Oh, man.
He got the poison anyway. Yeah, they're both dead. It's a draw either way.
And I'm bringing in the source material for Outbreak, which we'll talk about later at some point. But we should say, both of these movies are recommendations from our patron, Chaz. These were his picks, and we decided these movies kind of feel of equal stature. Neither necessarily feels like a punishment. So for the first time, maybe this is the only time we're going to do this. I don't know. Maybe it'll happen again. They're both getting equal stature in this episode.
That's right. No punishment here. Well, I guess we'll reveal later how we feel about both of these movies. So maybe one of them is more of a punishment than the other, but we're going to keep you in suspense.
Right.
How about that? No fallen warriors here. Because, yeah, last time we did the trivia battle at the end of the show, which, you know, of course, we'll do at the end here as always. So stick around for that. What even happened on the last trivia battle? I don't even remember. I feel like it just devolved into, like, oh, well, we're both going to watch these movies anyway.
I think it was the most pathetic trivia battle we've ever had. And if you pull out that damn incinerator gag this episode, Jordan, I'm driving out to Prairieville with a tire iron with your name on it, my friend.
Dustin Hoffman movies, go.
No!
That was a good no. That was a good no. I like that.
Thank you.
Yeah, so thank you, Chaz, for picking these for your patron recommendation. And sweet, let's get into it. 1990s Arachnophobia.
My transition was going to be, speaking of no, how about 1990s Arachnophobia? But I'm kind of glad I didn't do that. Well, I did it now, but at least it's not the intro to this movie.
I like that. I like that. But I was going to mention, Nick, right up the top here. So we have a movie directed by Frank Marshall again. And you know what movie that I love that was directed by Frank Marshall that also starts in the jungle?
Congo.
That's right. That's right. And tell me you don't love Arachnophobia. Just tell me right away. I know you love this movie. How could you not love this movie?
Oh, man. So I loved this movie whenever I was a kid. I didn't quite enjoy it to that degree this time. Now, it wasn't like Congo where I was like yelling my disdain at the screen at every passing second. I did enjoy this, but I'm not sure if I love it. Jordan, I'm not sure if I love it.
I feel like maybe that's just some residual Congo hate bleeding over here. You know, you just can't accept that Frank Marshall is the genius that he is.
Congo's like a virus, man. It's worse than Ebola. just keep that theme going.
Well, you know, I was hoping maybe since you didn't have the source material that you were basing the movie against, like you did with Congo, I was hoping maybe that would give Arachnophobia an edge for you and you would just embrace it in its Spielbergian produced awesomeness. But yeah, let's get into it. So thoughts. You said you used to love this as a kid. I remember watching this as a kid as well and not really loving it then, thinking it was supposed to be super serious and laughing at it, like at how ridiculous it was. Like it was so bad, it was so good to me. But now watching it, I realize it's going for this really great mixture of tone. I love the comedy mixed in with the horror, and you still have like some creepiness and some jump scares and some awesome, you know, prosthetics and some goo and some gnarly deaths and everything. But yeah, I just love the lightness of it. This was one of the first films produced for Hollywood Pictures, which was, you know, Disney's production offshoot where they could make some more adult oriented stuff. And I feel like because of that, you know, you have some of that lightness that Disney brings, but obviously they're trying to go a little bit edgier, a little bit darker. And I dig it. I dig all that stuff.
Yeah. For me, this movie was one of the first, if not the first horror movie, like quote unquote horror, that I watched all the way through. And my experience was basically like, I remember seeing the commercials for it where, what did they called it? Like, a thrillomedy, Jordan. It was a thrillomedy. That's how they marketed it.
Thrillomedy. Yeah.
But I was in my room one day and I came out of my room and my brother and sister were hiding like outside of the living room, like around the corner. And I was like, what are y'all doing? And I guess they were young too. I mean, my sister was probably like 7 and my brother was probably like 4. And they're like, Pop's watching a scary movie, the scary spider movie. So I go in there and the movie had just started. Nothing had really even happened yet. Like they're still in the jungle. I go in there and I ask my dad what he's watching. He's like, you're too scared to watch this. You don't want to watch this. And as soon as he told me that, I was like, I'm watching this movie.
Right. Like it's awesome. Challenge accepted.
Right. So I watched it with my dad. And I mean, I've already told you this before. Like my dad had like a pretty like black sense of humor, like pretty morbid, like, you know, watching King Kong with him, the original. Every time King Kong stomps on someone, my dad was just laughing his head off. So I was like, well, that's what funny is. Funny is a gigantic creature stomping on puny little humans. That's hilarious. So he and I were laughing through most of this movie and people getting bitten and killed by the spiders. And, you know, just the spiders running around and terrorizing people. So I remember like laughing very heartily and kind of finding like a thrill in the fact that this was kind of like a movie that was freaking my siblings out and they were too scared to watch it. And watching it now, it's drier than I remember. But
yeah,
I feel like I don't want to skip into me feeling the dryness. Do you want to talk about the plot of this? Because it's a really easy to sum up plot. It's about spiders and they kill people, Jordan.
Right, right. It's basically like has somewhat of the slasher movie format to it where, you know, we just kind of jump around to the spiders killing various people in this town. But so I dug that about it. Yeah. So basically the plot is Jeff Daniels is a doctor. He's moved with his family to the country, to a small town. Here in this town, we discover that there is a spider that's been brought over from Venezuela accidentally when they're on this expedition. It opens up in this jungle expedition. One of the guys gets killed by the spider and his body sent back to this small town. The spider's mated with like a house spider and the spiders kind of just start to invade the town. Jeff Daniels is, of course, the one with arachnophobia. He had a traumatizing experience as a child, which paralyzes him anytime he's around a spider, which I love that detail of his character. And they use that to great effect in the finale. But yeah, so it's basically them trying to figure out how are these people that have that keep dying in the town, you know, what's happening to them. He's the big city doctor, so there's a lot of like small town politics stuff between him and the doctor that decided not to retire and keep his job. And so he's basically moved his whole family here and doesn't have a leg to stand on. His house that he bought, the basement is rotting away where there's a wine cellar that he was excited about. So yeah, there's like a lot of stuff in this that I didn't remember the first time around. I feel like it was one of those as a kid, like, let's just fast forward to the gooey parts, you know, let's fast forward to the spider kills. But yeah, it is a slower pace. There is a lot of just build up to when we get to the mayhem in the town. There's a lot of like the small town stuff and the discovery of what's happening and all that. So I could see how the dryness there would maybe turn you off a little bit.
Well, before that, there's a 20-minute setup scene, so you don't even get to Jeff Daniels in this small town until 20 minutes in, because the opening sequence is set in the jungles in South America and in this, how do you say it, Tepui. It's one of those, like, if you've seen the movie Up, those big tabletop mountains that look really gnarly, that have jungle around them and giant waterfalls coming off of them. Which I suspect, Chaz, I think something that he and I have in common is we really like when movies have jungles. And both the movies we're talking about today have jungles.
Yeah, it seems like it.
And I love these jungle scenes.
Yeah. I thought the jungle scene here was great. Yeah, I thought it, like, the production value looked really gnarly. Maybe, like, I know there was a lot of critique of Congo and how, like, some of the jungle scenes there looked a little fake. But this was all shot on location. This looks really good. The cinematography was really beautiful. So all this was really surprising. Haven't watched this movie since I was 11 on like a crappy VHS. So just seeing it in widescreen and high def, I was just like, wow, this movie looks really good, actually. And I guess you shouldn't be shocked when it's produced by Spielberg, directed by Frank Marshall. So yeah, I thought it looked really good.
Yeah, man, those might be my favorite 20 minutes of the movie, that and then the last 20 minutes.
Oh, yeah.
It's really cool looking, man. But I kind of wonder, like, with the pacing, you got 20, because it's not a long movie. It's like, you know, an hour and a half long. But you have 20 minutes before you get to the main setting, Canema, California, which Canema is actually the name of the area where they filmed in Venezuela.
Right.
But,
which is weird.
Yeah, it is weird. And you have, like, these weird, like, storybook looking houses in this real town in California that they shot in. You know what, Jordan? I can tell you what it is. My complaint is so oddly specific and obnoxious. It's this. It involves the soundtrack to the movie composed by Trevor Jones. Jordan, you know when you're watching a horror movie and the monster comes in and there's a stinger? You know, it's like, dun! Mm-hmm. There are no stingers in this, Jordan. When the spiders come on the screen, it's always silent. And I want it to be like, dun! Like, I want that music to hit. And I want to jump and be like, oh, crap. You know?
Really? I thought I remembered some moments like that where there's little music going on. Especially, I mean, definitely in the final scene, I had a note here about the score there. And it just felt like a nonstop kind of silent movie, horror movie scene. That finale in the basement with Jeff Daniels and the music's just going and going and going. But I thought I remembered some stuff early on too, where it was like a little stinger.
Well, I'm thinking about like that stupid loser doctor, like when he's on the treadmill and then his wife is in bed and it bites him on the toe. Like when the spider makes the appearance there, I want it to be like, dun! Like I want that, that stinger to hit. And I want to be like, oh crap, there's a spider coming, you know? Or like the football field scene, there's a scene that's actually kind of disturbing. I remember like not being scared, but disturbed by it as a kid, where the spider crawls into a kid's helmet when he's playing football and he gets on the field and jumps up to catch the ball and he dies in midair and all the other players just hit his dead, lifeless body, which is kind of messed up if you think about it.
Right. I like how a lot of these deaths are like, oh, they could be blamed on other things, you know, like, oh, he just got hit. He got tackled too hard and like they could just blame it on that. Like he had like a heart attack or something, or his neck was broken or whatever. Or the guy on the treadmill, like he's an old guy. He just overdid it and he got bit by the spider. So like how there's like all these little details like that where it's like, oh, the townspeople could just blame it on something else. But in the end, it's revealed it was really the deadly spiders.
It was the spiders all along. Well, also, while I'm talking about the music, and I've only talked about this for a second, so I buy the soundtracks to all the movies. I bought the one for this, and it's such a weird, like, 1990 artifact. The Trevor Jones score, I think, is pretty good, even though it doesn't have, like, cheap jump scares that most people don't like and will criticize a movie for that I want in this movie that's not there and I'm being unfair about.
Well, did you feel like there were no jump scares?
No, I want jump scares, Jordan. I want cheap jump scares.
See, I felt like there were jump scares in this. And maybe that's just because I'm a wuss and I don't watch a whole lot of horror movies and you're like way too desensitized maybe. But I was like I was talking about the tone and the comedy that's kind of mixed in with the horror here. And it's, yeah, it's really light horror. It's not anything that you're really going to be actually scared about or like walk away disturbed from. But there were honestly moments where when the spiders jumped out, I jumped in my seat or I was like maneuvering my body in a certain way, like, ugh, get off me, you know, like when it was crawling on Jeff Daniels or something. So maybe that was just me. Maybe like you, like I said, you're just too desensitized. But I was definitely like jumping at parts and felt a little lame because this is honestly not a scary horror movie. But I was like, ah, okay, oh, there's a spider. All right, this is funny. They're getting bit and they're dying.
Right. I'm like, man, where's the blood orgy and the chainsaw sound effects?
Yeah.
Well, another thing is this, man. Are you scared of spiders?
Not really. I mean, I'm not going to get paralysis and lay on the ground like Jeff Daniels when one crawls by.
Okay. All right. That's fair enough. That's fair enough. I'm not really scared of them either. But hey, you know what I am scared of? Bad 1990 pop songs, which this soundtrack is full of, Jordan. You have like this really cool atmospheric Trevor Jones music, which is kind of like throwback, like creepy horror thriller music from like the golden age of cinema. It's really good. But if you you buy the CD soundtrack album, there are all these weird pop songs that have like, you know, that can drum, that can snare drum sound from the 80s. You know, like in the early 90s, like no one cared about that kind of music anymore. And people were like moving on, but they hadn't figured that out yet. Like they're still like pushing that kind of music. So it's one of the weirdest soundtracks I've ever purchased. Like for this show of the movies we've covered, you have all these movie quotes like throughout the soundtrack. They have like sound clips from the movie, basically at the start and end of every track.
I love that. You don't love that?
That's cool. I'm fine with it, Jordan.
Okay.
But then you get to like all these weird random songs. So they alternate. You'll get like a Trevor Jones music piece for a couple minutes. Then a sound clip of like John Goodman stepping on a spider and being like,
yeah, that's right. I'm bad.
I think they've had the "That's Right, I'm Bad" clip like 3 times on here.
Oh, they've got to. A few times. Yeah, I wouldn't be surprised.
I'm fine with it. But then you go from that to like a song where it's a crappy 1990 like pop rock song that sounds like it's from the mid 80s where they haven't like gotten a, like cool 90s music yet. It from like a musical act that you've never heard of that you really have to hit Google hard for. The lyric will like reference a spider for a second. Like, I don't know. You got my skin crawling like a spider, baby. We'll be like, you're like, wait, what?
Wasn't the credit song in this something like that where there's like a bad spider pun or like, you can bite me now or something? I don't know. What was it? I'm trying to remember.
There are like 7 or 8 crappy pop songs on here, and none of them are in the movie. Except, dude, that last song, Don't Buck Me, that plays over the end credits of this, it's Jimmy Buffett. It's Jimmy Buffett, dude. It's the weirdest lyrics. The lyrics are so weird.
See, just like Congo, I feel like you're letting extraneous material sour you on this movie. Don't bring the soundtrack's problems into this discussion, man. This is about the movie and what we have on screen here, man.
Okay, you're right. I'm being an 8-legged freak. I'm sorry. That's not fair.
John Goodman. What, how good was he in this?
He's great. Just, you know what, Jordan? This movie's a lot of fun. This movie is a lot of fun. Like, I'm saying all this. This doesn't get, like, a bad score for me. This is, like, I thought I was going to go and give it an 8 out of 10. And then, like, halfway through, I was like, man, like, the audio, there's not, like, a lot of sound effects and things happening. Which I think is because the spiders killed everything, like, all the crickets and everything.
Right.
So there's, like, nothing to, like, no Foley effects to put in the background if there's not music. But then, you know, you get to the big finale at the end where they're, man, I remember those scenes like 32 years ago, like they happened yesterday. I watched it with my dad where all the spiders come into the room at the end, like Jeff Daniels races home. And these are hyper intelligent spiders commanded by the master spider, right? By the spider general. So the spider general has called all the spiders that have dispersed through the town back to the house. So Jeff Daniels goes to, like, get his family out of the house when he realizes that his basement and barn are, like, the home base for all the spiders. And that the spiders are basically breeding, like, another queen and another egg sac that'll be, like, the master spider race that will wipe out humanity, right? And it's all at his house.
How cool was that pulsing, oozing egg sac in the cellar? Like, it's just so gnarly 90s. I loved it.
It's so good, man, with all those awesome practical effects and all those real spiders. Like, just lots of, like, mostly almost all real spiders in this movie that they really took great care of. As Jeff Daniels said, better care than they did the humans.
Right. Apparently, they flew in, like, 300 of those spiders. And, yeah, they had to go through great lengths not to hurt any of them.
Yes. Those Avondale spiders, which apparently outside of the gigantic bird-eating tarantula Big Bob that we mentioned earlier that plays the spider general, that could hurt you. All these other spiders that they use were harmless, but, you know, in the movie, they look demonic, you know, they look evil.
Yeah.
And they're all just coming out of the walls and every crevice as Jeff Daniels gets back home to get his family out of the house. And the spider general has basically commanded that he and his family be killed. So, man, that is just, that last 20 minutes is so fun and so awesome. But I just remember when the TV is on and a spider crawls over the TV as his family are all gasping and suddenly horrified. And then Jeff Daniels knocks the TV over and there's spiders like all over the wall behind the TV. It's just such a great visual. I do love the end, man. The end is like a 9 out of 10. The whole movie overall, I give a 7 out of 10. But that is just a crazy, crazy spiderific climax, man. It's great.
Definitely. I love when they're trapped in the bathroom and the spiders are like crawling through the doorknob, like they're pushing the panel of the doorknob up and like crawling out, like there's, you're showing them like that they're so strong, like obviously they've like unscrewed this panel so they can get through, but you know, then they're trying to go out the window and like the family gets out, but then the spiders descend before Daniels can get out, so he's stuck. And then that fall through the, from the stairs into the basement, like, man, that was a gnarly stunt too, where it's cool that they set that up earlier with the rotted wood in the cellar, and then he falls through the floor and then has the showdown with the queen and the general spider. Like, all that stuff was just amazing, like highlight of the movie for sure.
Yeah, man, you can tell that Frank Marshall, obviously he's working with Spielberg here as a producer, and this is an Amblin movie, that he was really biting a lot of Jaws, no pun intended. So you have Chekhov's nail gun from earlier in the movie when he's trying to work on the rotten basement and realizes that it's all crappy and he can't do anything. And he just like drops his nail gun on the ground. So it's still there. So he's got to use it on the spider, right? It's just like the air tank in Jaws, you know, where you're told early in the boat trip that makes up the third act of the movie, like, these things are really explosive. You cannot be careless with these because they'll explode. So that just puts it in the back of your mind so that it's in Roy Scheider's mind at the end of the movie to blow the shark up with it. That's the nail gun, man. It's just been waiting down there for Jeff Daniels to kill the giant spider with it.
Same thing with the wine, too, you know, where he's got this really expensive wine bottle, the Chateau, and he's throwing the bottles at Big Bob at one point because he's, you know, the cellar shelves have fallen over and he's stuck on under them. There is some comedy here too, where it's like, obviously, I don't know, I kind of love horror movies like this in a way where you can kind of see the strings, the punches being pulled by the characters, where, like, you know, I feel like he could get up and, you know, get out from under those shelves and just go step on this spider and squish it. But that wouldn't be a great climax, obviously. You know, so it's like, oh no, I'm stuck under these shelves and I've got to throw these bottles, but I keep missing. And then he comes across the chateau and he's like, not the chateau. So that was a great callback too.
Well, let me ask you this. What did you think of Jeff Daniels as the heroic protagonist in this film overall?
Man, I just love Jeff Daniels in general. I thought he was really good as this kind of snarky, sarcastic doctor in this country town. He's, you know, kind of got to come up against the country doctor who doesn't want to retire. I dug all that. Like, it is a slower pace, and I feel like it could be tightened up, but I still really enjoyed all those early scenes, too. And I thought his dynamic with his wife was really great. they didn't give her too much to do, but I felt like I really believed their relationship, and you know, she was perfect in that part. Just same with him as a dad with the kids. Like I just really dig this early 90s Jeff Daniels vibe.
I love Jeff Daniels. I did feel watching it now that I also enjoyed him a little more when I was younger. He's not like, I don't know if he's entirely likable in this. Like, he's really snarky. Like, he has a lot of kind of dark one-liners, which were pretty funny, I guess. But he wasn't, like, quite as likable. And again, like, I'm bringing some bias into this movie, Jordan, because he's like a big city San Francisco doctor, right? And he has this inclination to move out to the country and get his family out to the country. But then what happens at the end, Jordan? He's like, F this, I'm going back to the city. And then he takes his wife back to the city. And I'm like, no, that's the opposite experience, man. You're supposed to go to the city and it's too crazy. And then you go back to the country, you know, where I'm from, where that's where you really want to be. But then I like the humor at the end where there's an earthquake and he just he and his wife just willfully ignore that it's happening.
Yeah, I like that this is basically like a cautionary tale. Like, don't move to the country because you can't control it and it's just crazy and spiders will kill you. But then, yeah, you go back to the city. You know, the whole joke is like, yeah, here we are where we can control our lives. And then the earthquake hits and it's like, ah, ha, ha. And then, of course, you know, the final kind of nail in the coffin, the chateau that he's been saving this whole time, they finally uncorked. It falls over with the earthquake and it starts dripping on the ground. So I love that little final touch.
Right. Should stay in the country, man. Jerk doctor's dead, so he's not in your way anymore. Everyone knows that you're a hero who killed all the spiders, and all the spiders are dead. Hey, maybe move to a different house that doesn't have a creepy barn anymore, but he should have stayed out there, man. He made the wrong decision.
He had a good setup, you know, in the end. You got rid of all the spiders. You know, you're the town doctor, so you've got a livelihood set up for you there. But yeah, maybe it's just the trauma of the scenario they couldn't handle. They've got to get back to the big city where things are more familiar.
Right, man. To me, the most traumatized person has got to be the girl from the shower scene. That was really interesting camera framing. The spider just crawls right between her boobs and is heading down toward her crotch before she knocks it down the drain.
Right. It's either headed down there or it's already down there and she screams. And yeah, that's got to be a really traumatic experience. So
if I'm her, and this is an allusion to the next movie we're going to cover, I'm just taking a chemical shower for the rest of my life. And that's it.
That's right.
I don't care if it burns my skin off.
All right. Well, final scores for Arachnophobia.
As I said, 7 out of 10. This is a fun movie. I do feel, I guess I'll get in a shot at Frank Marshall here. He's married to Her Satanic Majesty, Kathleen Kennedy, who's trying to ruin Star Wars. And I feel like Frank Marshall, he's a good movie producer, and I feel like he's really trying here. But one thing, and you know what, Jordan, I'm going to be honest, I do think that Congo probably brought this out more. I feel like Frank Marshall doesn't quite have a handle on tone, at least as far as I perceive tone. Because with Congo, you know, I'm watching it and I'm like, this is the dumbest shit I've ever seen. This is so stupid. But you're enjoying it, right? And Chaz and a lot of our listeners are enjoying that movie and being like, dude, it's supposed to be stupid. It's just like dumb fun and I'm not getting it, right? But for me, I'm like pick a tone. Like, I either just want this to be all out stupidity or I want you to make like a really epic, awesome jungle movie. And maybe that's my issue with why I can't go over a 7 with this, where I was thinking like I was going to enjoy it more, is I feel like maybe either I want this to be funnier or I want this to be scarier. I feel like for me, like the tone splits the difference in a way that's, it's fun, but I feel like I could have enjoyed it more if it went further in either direction. Like, I think someone, if I'm remembering this right, and this is going way back, but I think someone called the movie Toothless to make some kind of spider pun in their review. I don't think that's quite fair. I mean, it's a solid movie, but I do wish it either like bit harder or like made me laugh harder, like one or the other.
I could see that. I think that's fair. I feel like I could enjoy this more, but I was surprised at how much I did. And I feel like for me, I'm kind of the opposite in a way with the tone and the Congo comparison, because to me, this just like vindicates my enjoyment of Congo and how I like the silly tone and how I argued that, you know, it's just a big, dumb B movie. It's not trying to be any more than that. It's just like a really highly produced giant stupid monster movie, you know. And this is kind of the same way, where I really enjoyed the lighthearted tone mixed with the creepy gore. And I agree. I feel like they could have pushed the limit in some places, but at the same time, it was a early Hollywood picture movie. You know, Disney's trying to break into this market, and you've got Jeff Daniels as this family man, and I guess they're trying to appeal to kids a little bit. I don't know. Was this rated R,
or was this PG-13?
PG-13. Yeah. So yeah, they're trying to appeal to that market. I don't know. I think it's good for what it is. I really enjoyed it and gave it 4 out of 5. But I agree. I didn't really find it laugh out loud funny in a lot of parts. And, you know, we talked about this before, that you'd saw it as a comedy when you first watched it with your dad laughing a lot. And I was expecting that a little bit. And like here, I was surprised again that how much some of the scenes kind of creeped me out, or I jumped from some of the scares and stuff. And I was like, I was not expecting to be at least momentarily scared, you know, by this movie. But again, not lastingly scared, because it is just kind of in. I like that Frank Marshall made this in a way. And I think he said people want to be laughing while they're scared, or something along those lines. Like, and that was,
I strongly disagree with his statement, because his statement was people don't want to be terrified. And damn it, I do want to be terrified, Frank Marshall. Right. I'm an extremist and I want to feel that ultimate terror. You just don't get it. You don't understand tone, you son of a bitch.
See, maybe that's where you're disconnecting with the movie, and that's where I'm connecting, because I'm like, yeah, I don't want to be terrified, really. I don't want to be disturbed, ultimately. I want to, like, kind of peek through the door, but not be fully exposed, you know? I want to have a little terror, but, you know, some comedy thrown in there. And I think that's why I always gravitate to horror comedies. And so this is just kind of right up my alley, but I can understand why you don't fully jive with it.
Speaking of up an alley, so my favorite shot watching this when I was like 9 or 10 was, and I want to know how you felt about this, the moment where the couple, they get killed by the spider basically off screen. It was in the popcorn they were eating while they were watching Wheel of Fortune. The husband basically grabbed a handful of popcorn the spider was in and ate it. And next thing you know, like, our heroes, you know, Jeff Daniels with a little party, a group of people, which we didn't mention, Julian Sands from Leaving Las Vegas.
Yeah.
Man, I love that dude. He's like a researcher here. He went on the original expedition at the start of the movie looking for the spider. But he's there too. Anyway, they see this couple on the couch and they're looking for like bites or like what happened. And then the spider just crawls out of the guy's nose. When I was like 10, man, I thought that was the coolest thing I'd ever seen. How'd you feel about that?
I love this scene. And that was one of the moments that I remembered most vividly from watching it as a kid. And it really creeped me out, just the idea of putting that spider in your mouth and not knowing it. And just, it just gives me the willies. But yeah, then watching it crawl out of the dude's nose, that was just freaky. And I think they used some prosthetics there, like a fake head, obviously, for that to happen. But I loved all that too. I thought that looked gnarly.
Cool, man. Well, final comment for me. So Frank Marshall, we've covered 2 out of 4 of the non-documentary films that he's made. There's only one other 90s movie, which is 1993's Alive. The other movie that he made was 2006's 8 Below. So I saw Alive back in the day, and I remember thinking it was solid. I would be curious to watch that again with like my current Frank Marshall doesn't understand tone bias to see how I feel about the tone there. So hopefully we cover that at some point. That's based on a true story.
I just throw in some awkward comedy there, maybe. I don't know.
Maybe. I just remember them when they're eating the chocolate bars. It made me want chocolate. But then when they eat people, I didn't really want to eat people. But hey, 8 Below from 2006, you know, I have a soft spot for Paul Walker. I've never watched that one, but who knows? Maybe that'll win me over. Since that was the last movie that he made, I'm going to guess that maybe it's not that great.
Hey, maybe we can do that as a punishment movie and then do Alive as a feature. Ooh. At one point.
Ooh, I like what you're laying down there, Jordan.
Yeah, let's do it. One of these days.
So we ready to put arachnophobia into the web? I was going to say put it to bed, and then I said web. It felt dumb. I'm going to go in the corner now.
Yes, let's move on to 1995's Outbreak.
So Outbreak Jordan, I did watch this movie back in the day. This was not the first R-rated movie I saw. A Few Good Men was the first R-rated movie I saw. I'd seen a few by this point, and I remember being surprised watching this that it was rated R, which I have some points to make there. But I didn't realize it was based on source material, Jordan. It was based on The Hot Spot, which is a nonfiction. No, not the Hot Spot. That's something else. The Hot Zone by Richard Preston, which I read to prep for this movie. Jordan, why'd I do that? What was I thinking?
Why did you do that?
That book is an incredible page turner. And even though it's nonfiction, you basically have like these graphics for the first 20 pages of the book that make you feel like you're getting on a roller coaster. It starts off with the story of this guy going to Africa, or this guy who lives in Africa, who gets Ebola. And it just shows you, like, this is what Ebola does to the human body. And it's horrific. Like, I believe Stephen King said the opening chapter to this book is like the scariest thing he's ever read. It's so terrifying and so gross. That's the first part of the book. The second part of the book is it shows you about an Ebola outbreak at a monkey house, like, you know, a very large building where monkeys are kept to be sold for scientific research. Not far from Washington, D.C., had an outbreak of Ebola, and it went airborne, and it killed all the monkeys, or most of the monkeys. They killed the rest. They put the rest to death, and it became airborne, which was terrifying, and they were so scared, like, wow, everyone is about to die, like, on Earth, because if this is airborne in humans, we're just all going to die, because it killed the monkeys in just a matter of days. But thankfully, thank God, it was not communicable. That particular strain, Ebola Restin, was not communicable to humans. So he shows you what it can do to humans, then how it could evolve to be airborne. So it's pretty terrifying. I read it. I read the old 90s paperback just because, man, those, I'm really starting to find that those are some of the most purely enjoyable books to read. But I read that before watching this movie, which I remember not thinking was that great back when I watched it in 1995. But this time I had the book in my mind. So I was like, man, like, when's blood going to be gushing out of people's anuses? Like, this isn't that great. What were they thinking?
They need to show me that. Yeah, that's exactly what I want to see.
So how about you? What was your experience with Outbreak?
I remember, again, watching this as a kid, probably like laying on the floor in my brother's room with him in bed and my mom in a recliner and falling asleep probably within the first 20 minutes and never saw the rest of the movie until now. Because talk about a slower pace. This is a slow pace here as well. Definitely drags in parts, but, you know, there's some exciting, thrilling stuff as well that we get into.
And this is directed by Wolfgang Petersen, who just passed away on August 12th. So RIP barely a month ago. And he directed Air Force One, which is a movie we both love a lot. He did The Perfect Storm in 2000, In the Line of Fire in 93, which I remember. I know a lot of people like that one. I'd watched that back in the day. And I remember being kind of bored by it a little bit, but I was like 12. And he did The Neverending Story.
Neverending Story, yeah.
He did Das Boot. I watched the five-hour version of that with my dad in high school where we didn't know it was 5 hours. And, man, that was an experience, I will say.
When is this thing going to end?
right. And then when it ends, how it ends, it's like, what? How brutal was that I sat through 5 hours of this really, really good movie, but then that's what you did to me at the end? It's amazing. That was really good. I don't know if I'll watch it again, but it was great. All I have to say, of all the things that this guy has done, Outbreak, I don't think, is near the top of that.
Yeah, I haven't seen a lot of those others, but coming off of Arachnophobia into this, like I said, a little slower pace, drags a bit, so it's a lot drier. I mean, we talked about Arachnophobia being a little dry in parts, but, you know, in the end, it's kind of a goofy creature feature. And this didn't quite have as much of that energy that I wanted. I mean, none of that energy, really. But, it does get into some exciting stuff with the hunt for the monkey and the helicopter chases and all that. But, yeah, you want to just get into the plot here, the setup?
Let's do it. Who has the honor, Jordan?
I did the last one. How about you do this one?
fine.
You read the book.
Right. So as much as that book is about Ebola, this movie actually kind of makes up its own virus. So it's not quite Ebola. It's something called the Motaba virus.
Motaba.
So we start off in 1967 in this African jungle. And man, here's a complaint that I have about this movie.
Right away. I thought we were setting this up. Let's just dive into the complaints.
Well, look, it doesn't feel like an African jungle. It doesn't feel like you're in Africa. But anyway, that's neither here nor there with the plot. There's this village in an African jungle where some soldiers are fighting. There's fighting and war going on. It's in the Kisangani mutinies, which I don't really know a lot about and won't pretend like I know a lot about. But these U.S. Army doctors fly down there, and it turns out all these soldiers that aren't dying of combat injury are dying of some deadly fever, some crazy virus. And they get a blood sample, and then they say, we're going to come back and save all you. But they don't. They nuke the entire town, and that's the opening scene. So you get a bunch of explosions early, Jordan.
Yeah, you do, but the explosions look kind of cheap. They look kind of crappy,
yeah, even
for 1995. I mean, right. They're obviously... Well, I say that. I was about to say, obviously, you couldn't blow up this town, but is that true in 95?
Clear and Present Danger came out the year before.
Right, we just watched Clear and Present Danger, where they literally explode a mansion. So you could give me a real explosion here outbreak. Come on.
Right. It's not the best looking explosions, but then you jump ahead 28 years... to Colonel Sam Davies, played by Dustin Hoffman. I love Dustin Hoffman, man. He is weird as hell in this movie. But I mean, career-wise, I really like Dustin Hoffman. He's a virologist. Yeah. Just kind of like sum this up. So he is really kind of paranoid that there's going to be some kind of virus that's going to overtake the Earth. And he kind of feels like he's like the guardian against that. And his greatest fears come true when Marcel from Friends, that's right, that wily, white-headed capuchin monkey, he comes into America with a group of monkeys. He's smuggled in, and Jimbo, who, dude.
Played by McDreamy.
Dude,
Patrick Dempsey himself. Yeah.
He looks like he came straight from the Lost Boys set. Like, his hair is all feathered, and he's got the leather jacket. It's wild, man.
It's kind of weird seeing him in that way.
And then especially when he starts getting sick, because he's like patient zero, and he's got like the bloodied out eyes, man. Again, he looks like he's from Lost Boys.
Yeah, he looks like he's high on heroin. I love it when he's on the airplane and the little kid is about to eat the cookie that he just spit out of, and the mom's like, no, don't bother that man. She's really thinking like, oh my God, he's got AIDS or he's on drugs or something, you know. Which, watching this, you know, we've got to talk about this post-coronavirus, or I don't know where we're at in coronavirus, but definitely this brings to mind our recent epidemic. And just seeing people coughing in public and then a little boy about to eat off of a half-eaten cookie that the sick man, I'm very obviously sick man, is, you know, has on his table. It's like, no, we have learned better. And so years later, coronavirus has taught us you don't eat or drink after anybody anymore.
What are you doing? Yeah, man, I remember watching Life Goes On, you know, that TV show from the early 90s, which I really enjoyed. But they kind of tried to tackle some difficult topics there. And it was really one of the first shows to directly kind of deal with the AIDS epidemic. And this girl's boyfriend has AIDS, and he drinks out of a glass, like at her parents' house. And her dad's washing the dishes that night, and he grabs the cup and he's about to start washing the cup that the boyfriend drank out of. And then he stops, and then he pulls out the trash can and just throws it away, man. Hmm. So it's like that era, that AIDS era. And I'm not going to stop talking about the story, right? The monkey bites him. That's how he gets the disease. He tries to smuggle this monkey to a pet shop, but he's so dumb, it's the wrong monkey. And the pet shop's like, no, man, we don't want that. The monkey gives him the Motaba and gives the pet store owner Motaba. But then he gets on the plane. And dude, the scene with the cookie, that is so extreme, right? The way that it's filmed, it's like, oh, this is disgusting. Don't eat the cookie. No, kid. And then later on... the disease gets fully dispersed in a town at a movie theater where this guy's coughing and you see all the germs flying in the air going into people's mouths as they're laughing at the movie, right? It's like really like over the top and extreme.
Right. Like, how did this not kill movie going when this came out in 1995, right? Everybody's in the theater watching this. And they're just showing like the virus spreading and then all these people dying. It's like, oh my God, what a turnoff for movie watching.
Right. Like, you're in a movie theater right now. This could be happening right now.
You're watching this during coronavirus pandemic. Yes,
right. And then the town gets quarantined. And then you have just going more to the extreme, like, the military comes and seals off the town. But, you know, a couple of families and pickup trucks are like, forget this. We're getting out right. of here.
I love it's the redneck, like, pickup truck people are like, and it feels... Not to get too political, but it feels very prescient in a way where, you know, we have a lot of people that you might say are also rednecks in 2020, 2021 during the coronavirus. They're like, oh, this is a hoax. This ain't real. I feel like those same people would be these people trying to get out of this town in the pickup trucks.
Well, I'm more focused on the extremeness of the scene where every time they hit a puddle in these trucks, it's like, boom, splash. Every pothole, like the truck jumps like 20 feet in the air, right? Like everything is so extreme about it. The helicopter has to shoot machine guns at the trucks. And thankfully doesn't shoot the one with the family in it. It shoots the one with the other group and it blows up and catches on fire and everyone inside burns to death in these loud crackling flames that are burning at like 10 trillion decibels.
Right.
Like, you've got that awesome Wolfgang Peterson extremeness, but then like the movie as a whole, this virus, especially if they're trying to basically say like, this is even worse than Ebola. Dude, like I said, I mean, I just read The Hotspot. This is a rated R movie. The gore and blood in this movie isn't past PG-13, man. And I feel like that's a huge whiff. I really feel like this could have been like a Tom Savini, like, makeup extravaganza. Like, you could have blood pouring out of people's eyes and mouths. I'm fine if you don't have people anally bleeding everywhere. But, dude.
That's what you really want to see.
In real life, like, I mean, 28 days later, you know how all the zombies are vomiting blood everywhere? Dude, that's what Ebola does to you. It basically takes over your body and starts transforming the inside of your body into Ebola. Like, it transforms you into itself. That's why your organs and tissues and everything liquefy, because they're turning into Ebola. And the way that it can spread the best is you basically just start vomiting blood everywhere. Like, blood starts spurting out of your body, and your blood is basically just Ebola. So you're just like splashing and shooting Ebola everywhere and infecting everyone around you with it. That would give you so many opportunities for like terrifying gore to like really, really affect your audience. And it never does anything like that, man. Not even close to that.
See, you're just grossing me out talking about it. So that's why they didn't want to throw that into this movie.
It's Frank Marshall garbage right there. People don't want to be terrified. Jordan doesn't want to be terrified.
That's right. They're trying to follow suit with Frank Marshall. Because I think there's a moment where they're like looking over the body of one of the Ebola victims and that you just see like a vague impression of it in the reflection of one of the hazmat suit people. Like they don't even focus in on what the face looks like.
No, you're right. And it's like, why are you being subtle with this, man? Like, scare me. Show me how bad this is.
You were talking about the moments with the pickup trucks and the helicopters and the explosions there where they're gunning down these guys trying to get out of town. And I feel like those are kind of interspersed into this movie that is a very different movie. Watching this, like I said, it's slow at times, it drags a bit. And I think that's kind of due to the nature of like, okay, we're trying to track down this virus, there's this unseen threat. So the movie feels like at times it gets scared that it's gonna get too boring or too uneventful, and it just throws in like, you know, these car chases or these helicopter chases and these explosions. Like, okay, I'm here for that and I enjoy that, but it doesn't feel like it really belongs in this movie either. It just kind of at times devolves into some silliness that doesn't quite fit. Did you feel the same way?
I did, man. There's a weird silliness throughout the movie, which, oh man, so I should bring this up. So Dustin Hoffman is this military doctor, and you have like this team of military doctors, and you also have this evil general who wants to just basically destroy the town. He's the guy who nuked the African town earlier.
Donald Sutherland.
Yeah, Donald Sutherland, dastardly Donald. He wants to have this virus basically for himself, for the government, so they can use it as like a biological weapon. But you have this team that goes there, and dude, like there's a moment in the movie with the team where the only people in the frame are Dustin Hoffman, Morgan Freeman, Kevin Spacey, and Cuba Gooding Jr. And I feel like those four people, those are the four people in that shot, right? Like, how unfortunate is it that you could just caption that screen as accused sexual offenders, right? Like,
yeah.
All four of those guys have kind of been, like, a little bit disgraced, some way disgraced, like Spacey. It's just really unfortunate. How unlucky were you, like, with 30 years in the future with this cast? But I guess in the movie, I mean, they're fine. They're just weird. It's weird. Dustin Hoffman, his tone is weird in the movie. He says things in a weird way. And I've seen a lot of Dustin Hoffman movies. And he does some wild stuff in a lot of those movies. He takes a lot of risks as an actor, and they usually pay off. But here, it's just, like, a little weird. He's, like, saying stuff so weird. And he's, like, off the leash sometimes. And it's like, wait, why are you being so off the leash right now, dude? Like, chill out.
I feel like all the characters in this are a bit flat, and they're all just kind of a little basic and a little underdeveloped. Like, there's nothing really that interesting about any of them. And that might be why I feel like Hoffman would take a script like this and then just try and swing and go for something really weird, or try, you know, take some risks just to try and make it a little bit more interesting. Like, he does have some cool moments where he gets to yell and get mad, right? But other than him being a doctor, him having a divorce with Rene Russo and kind of like their tenuous relationship, I don't really feel like I know him that well, other than like a stereotypical hero, like, I'm gonna stand up for what's right. I couldn't describe his personality. It's just Hoffman. I feel like all the actors here are basically just playing themselves, and that's just not quite as interesting as, say, Arachnophobia.
Yeah, I can agree with that. It doesn't really feel like there is, like, a solid character in this movie anywhere. Maybe Donald Sutherland's evil general, just because he goes so over the top.
Yeah, but even there, he's just kind of like a cardboard cutout villain, you know? He's just like, they could really dive into the human motivation for, like, why, you know, he wants to cover this up and, like, just give us some humanity, you know, but I feel like he's just dastardly villain Donald Sutherland.
Right. When people are like, you can't just murder other people, he's like, everyone is so sentimental. That's what's wrong with this country. It is really over the top.
Yeah, I feel like that was his argument. He was fighting against sentimentality or something. Like, he said that multiple times, right? Like, oh, you're just sentimental. How are you going to not kill this whole town of people? You just got soft on me. Like, no, Donald, I'm pretty sure that it's just wrong to murder a whole town of people when, you know, you have a cure and you should just, like, own up to whatever biological weapon you created, you know, like, it's gonna come out.
Yeah, and we've pretty much just described the whole plot of the movie. There's not really more to it. Basically, Donald Sutherland wants to just nuke this town where everyone has come down with Motaba and is dying, including Kevin Spacey, whose suit rips. And Dustin Hoffman's like, well, wait, if we can find the host, then we can magically make a cure to this in 3 or 4 minutes and save everyone. So let's not blow up the whole town. And that's really the main conflict, is he and Cuba Gooding Jr. track down the host, which they figure out is Marcel from Friends. And Marcel is living in this forest outside this nice house where this girl has been feeding him. And they have to go try to get him so that they can get a cure to the virus before Donald Sutherland blows the whole town up. And you don't really, like, know anyone in this town. Rene Russo's there and sick and on her deathbed. But it doesn't really give you a lot of reasons to care about the town either, other than, like, well, it's wrong to blow up a town full of people.
I mean, it's just wrong. Yeah, they use Rene Russo as, like, a crutch, I feel like, where it's like, okay, bring in the love interest, bring in the motivation for Dustin Hoffman. The clock is ticking now. She might die from this virus, so he's got to find the cure. It feels a little forced, and then it ends a little bit anticlimactic in the final scene between them where he's giving her the cure and she's getting better, and then it just kind of ends. Like, and going back to the monkey stuff too, don't you like how they figure out, they find this picture of the monkey. There's like a whole convoluted way where they go about tracking down the host. But then they find a picture of the monkey, show it on TV, and then it's like 5 minutes later, they've captured the monkey. You know, it's like, it doesn't take them long at all. It's just very coincidental or very, like, kind of easy that they, you know, that this lady would see the TV, and then her daughter had been talking about this monkey, and then they find the monkey. There's a little tension there where, like, Cuba Gooding Jr. is trying to shoot the monkey with a tranquilizer dart, and the little girl's in the way and everything. Like, you know, it had some moments that work, for sure. But, yeah, I felt like it was solid in the beginning. Like, I kind of had to get into the mood or the tone, you know, coming off of Arachnophobia, where, like, this kind of more serious tone, Hoffman's really dedicated to trying to track down this virus. But then, yeah, I feel like by the end they're like, oh, this is getting boring, let's throw in some, like, wild helicopter chases and you know, chasing after this monkey, and, you know, they're gonna blow up the town and all this stuff. Like, it just gets kind of silly, and you're like, what happened in this movie? Like, I guess we just need to go watch Contagion or something.
I should mention, too, they do show a lady having to leave her family to go to the quarantine area to try to get you to see, like, oh, these are just real everyday people. But, I mean, it doesn't really hit that much.
Yeah, I totally forgot about that.
The helicopter chases and all the action beats that he throws in there that are kind of strenuous are really what keep me going in this movie, man.
Yeah. Yeah, I mean, they did a good job to insert those in, because I think they were right. I don't know if those scenes were there originally in the script, but I can imagine them just like, all right, we're just going to have a serious, thrilling drama about infectious disease. And then they make the movie and they're like, you know what? It's 1995. We need more helicopter chases.
Right. Let's blow some stuff up. Let's blow some shit up.
Because it's 1995. I feel like helicopters and explosions, that's what you get in 95 and 94.
Hey, while we're complaining about things not being quite what they could have been, so the score for this movie, because I got the soundtrack for this, it doesn't have a bunch of random crappy pop songs on it. It's only music by James Newton Howard, who's a composer that I really love, man. He did the score for Sixth Sense, which is one of my favorites. He did The Fugitive, another one of my favorites. He did a lot of the music for The Dark Knight. This guy's great, but man, this is like one of the most like nondescript film scores ever. There's no like resonant themes in the music. It's really anonymous. It really like kind of bites on, because I'm going to keep using bites as my verb today. It really bites on like Jerry Goldsmith action cues. That's a really nerdy reference, but the score even is just like, man, like this could have been a little better. Could have done better, James Newton Howard. I mean, like, you had like 2 weeks to do the 3-hour score for King Kong in 2005 and you crushed that. Like, what happened here, man?
Yeah, I couldn't tell you a moment from this movie that had a score. Like, it doesn't stand out to me. I can't remember any part.
Yeah, man. It's just like, it's just okay. It's not a bad movie.
Yeah, it's
like,
not bad. It's not bad. It's okay.
What would you give this?
So yeah, final star rating, I give this a 3 out of 5.
Hey, yeah, I give it a 6 out of 10, man. Same page.
There you go. Well, moving on to our movie connection. So did you have anything in particular to connect this back to our last episode? We covered Ninja Scroll from 1993.
Yeah, there's like a really easy connection. And if you have one, hopefully it's not the same one, but I mean, like, you can't pass this up. In Ninja Scroll, they say, like, oh, this village, don't go there, with, like, the convoluted plot, right? Where they go through all this stuff, and it's really about a gold heist at the end. Don't go to this village, because this deadly virus has wiped everyone out. And then we go straight from that to an epidemic episode, where we have deadly spiders wiping out a town, and then literally a virus wiping out an entire town. So, pretty smooth connection there.
Nice. I didn't have that one. I had something a little bit more specific to tie Arachnophobia to Ninja Scroll. So.
Oh, I hoped you would. I hoped you would.
Yes, yes. So in Ninja Scroll, we have Naked Snake Lady that we talk a lot about. And we have a scene where Jubei is laying on the ground, and it looks like he's kind of paralyzed as these snakes are crawling all over him, and Naked Snake Lady's about to get him. Well, in Arachnophobia, you have the final scene with Jeff Daniels, and he talked about how he was paralyzed in fear because of these spiders, and you have the general spider crawling up his leg, but then he gets the upper hand, and the spider crawls into a 2x4, and he smashes down one side of the 2x4, and the spider goes flying into the circuit board that's on fire and gets electrocuted.
There you go. Nice.
A nice green goo pops out. I love it. Give me more goo, Outbreak. We want more blood. We want more anus blood and we want more goo.
The scene in Arachnophobia where the John Goodman exterminator, was his name Derwin?
Delbert?
Delbert, yeah. When he steps on the spider, dude, the goo and then that potato chip crunching noise they yes. get is so great. I was going to say,
that potato chip crunch is so good.
I was too hard on Arachnophobia earlier. I feel like watching it. I could watch it again right now.
Now that we've talked about Outbreak, yeah, you're like, actually, Arachnophobia is pretty good, yeah, comparatively.
Yeah. Hey, Chaz, thanks for recommending these, though. My greatest pleasure out of all of this was finally reading The Hot Spot. I do not think
The Hot Zone would
have done it. God dog it. God dog it. I'm not even going to, like, recut that so that I can pretend like I said it right this time. Yeah. The Hot Zone. I really enjoyed that book. But I enjoyed watching both of these movies again to a certain degree. So thanks, Chaz. Appreciate
it. Thanks, Chaz. Well, you know what else you might get wrong, Nick?
Hold it! Pop quiz, hot shot.
Some of my questions for the trivia battle. Ooh, here we go.
What kind of garbage did you do this time? What did you do? Do I even want to know?
Why would you expect me to do anything amiss for this? I don't know. All right, so I'm bringing back Fred Willard's Magnificent Movie Trivia.
Oh, thank God. Thank God. At least you're asking me questions this time.
At least there's questions. And they're probably all going to be really easy because most of these are. But he has a section in his book for animal flicks. So I had to go with that this time with spiders and monkeys. Come on. Perfect opportunity.
Love it, dude. Love it. Well, I went with John Goodman questions.
Oh, nice. I love John Goodman.
Sweet. Cool. Oh, no. Well, then you might get all these right.
Well, you know, my memory is crap, so probably not.
All right. Well, you want to Fred Willard me first?
Yeah, let's do it. First question. Michael Jackson's Will You Be There is heard during which film's credits? Is it A, Andre, B, Free Willy, C, Flipper, or D, Buddy?
Oh, dang. You know, what's the one where he says, hold me like the River Jordan? Is that Will You Be There?
I don't know.
It's like, hold me like the River Jordan. Andre, it feels like that could have played at the end there, but I don't feel like it had the budget to, like, pull a Michael Jackson song. So I'm just going to guess Free Willy.
You got it. All right. Free Willy.
Yes.
That's right. Jordan right will on. Hold you like the River Jordan. With his right. trivia, with his easy trivia questions.
Well, thank you for your sweet touch there, Jordan. All right, well, here's my first question. Which of these John Goodman films was shot in our home base of Baton Rouge, Louisiana? Was it A, The Velvet Rope, B, Everybody's All-American, C, The Big Easy, or D, Always?
Was it The Big Easy?
No, it was not. See, you asked me all those trick questions last time about Studio Ghibli stuff, so I figured...
So you're trying to trick me, yeah.
Well, here's the thing, though, Jordan. Everybody's All-American was shot here in Baton Rouge. It's like a pretty famous movie locally, so, you know, I thought you might know it, and you didn't.
I didn't.
Man, I used to watch this movie a lot when I was a kid. It's about an LSU player, man, and they filmed this thing all over Baton Rouge, including at the state capitol. Really famously, when they went to shoot at the state capitol in November, when they made this film, it snowed that day. You know, it snows like every 7 years here. So they got like the most beautiful, gorgeous footage at the state capitol of it snowing. Wow. And then they looked at it and they were like, this doesn't look like Louisiana. Like, we can't use this. They had to reshoot it when it wasn't snowing later.
Nobody's balls are sweating off in this shot.
Right.
That's weird, man. I've never heard of this movie, honestly.
Yeah, it's got Dennis Quaid in it. It's a good one, man. I haven't watched it since I was younger, so I don't know. I was probably pretty biased being that, you know, so strongly connected to LSU. I'm a football season ticket holder.
What year did this come out?
In 1988.
Okay. So can't cover it, but maybe I'll track it down.
Yeah, it's got Jessica Lange in it. If anything, just to look at all the Baton Rouge locales. And the Big Easy, I mean, obviously they filmed in New Orleans, but I looked at the shooting locations. I actually thoroughly researched this question, and it looks like they only filmed in New Orleans. So,
all right. Well, that makes sense. I would hope they would. but you never know. So my next animal flick question is, what is Babe the Pig's job in the 1995 movie Babe? Was it A, protecting the farmer, B, hunting mice, C, herding sheep, or D, gathering corn?
Well, is that a trick question? Because obviously he herds sheep. That's like his big thing that he does. I don't think he had like another task before he started herding the sheep besides just being a pig. So I guess just herding the sheep, dude.
Yeah, that's it. That's an easy question for you.
Oh, man, what's with this?
What's with Fred Willard? So come easy. On, Fred.
Right. Thanks, Fred. I missed you, Freddy.
Don't worry. I've got some harder ones coming.
Well, if you get this wrong, it's over, so.
Oh, yeah. Never mind.
This is one of my most delicious questions, though. It's making my mouth water. This is another one that's near and dear to my heart. Who played John Goodman's advisor in 1991's King Ralph, which had the greatest tasting Burger King bacon cheeseburger tie-in of any movie ever made? Dude, the bacon cheeseburger tie-in that Burger King did for King Ralph, it was the first time I ever ate a bacon cheeseburger when I was like 10. I made my mom buy me like 50 of these. Like I think I got heart disease when I was 10. Like I like switched to like a no salt diet for a little while. All that to say,
at 11,
who played the titular King Ralph's advisor in that film? Was it A, Leslie Nielsen, B, Frank Langella, C, Martin Short, or D, Peter O'Toole?
Was it Martin Short?
No, you lost already. It was Peter O'Toole. No.
I was going to say Peter O'Toole, but then I second guessed myself.
No. Oh, gosh.
I haven't seen King Ralph. See, you asked me all the John Goodman questions I didn't know. Come on. Ask me about Coen Brothers, John Goodman. Ask me about Spielberg. Ask me about John. I don't know. Yeah. Come on.
I feel like we're back to the mean here, man. All right, Jordan. Well, you lost. It's all over. Right. But
thanks a lot, Fred.
Save those hard Fred Willard questions for next time. And of course, with these two, I was scared that they were too easy. But my hard question later. Now I'm going to save these. I'm going to save my hard ones.
All right.
One of my last questions is so obnoxious. I'm definitely saving it. Well, Jordan, what are we watching next episode? Because we're doing another patron request twofer.
Yeah, so next time we are doing one of our patrons, Doug, from Good Times, Great Movies. Or I guess Doug and Jamie, they are patrons of our show and good friends of the show. Great show. Covers 80s movies. They have picked Night of the Demons and Night of the Demons 2. So Night of the Demons being an 80s movie, that'll be our quote-unquote punishment movie, our Fallen Warrior review movie, and then Night of the Demons 2, a 90s movie. I'm guessing that we'll probably do something similar here where we might dedicate equal time to both of those, because it sounds like Night of the Demons is just straight up classic horror 80s movie. I haven't seen either of these. And then
me neither.
You know, with horror sequels, Night of the Demons 2 sounds like it just goes a little bit wackier, a little crazier. So we'll have to see. Yeah, I'm excited for this one.
Oh, I see what you're doing here, Doug. Night of the Demons 2 has Christine Taylor from Hey Dude. I see what you're doing. I know you're a big Hey Dude fan, Doug.
All right. I loved Hey Dude back in the day.
Yeah, man. Also, it looks like I win nothing because we're going to be both watching these movies.
That's right. See, you and all your crazy John Goodman questions. You win nothing. We believe in nothing.
Awesome, man. Well, Good Times, Great Movies. Thank you for the recommendation.
That's right. Thank you, guys. So thanks, everybody, for listening. Check us out on our Patreon. If you want to also subscribe and get some of our bonus content, you can find us at patreon.com/filmshake. If you want to email us any comments or ideas for the show, shoot us an email at filmshakepodcast@gmail.com. And we'll catch you next time for more Film Shake.
Take it easy.
Let me tell
Man, that was like a metronome.
Yeah.
Great clapping right there.
Yes, sir.
Amazing. All right. I have my extremely brief notes.
I finish all my coffee here.
Get up.
All right.
Arachnophobia. And outbreak.
Those are your notes. Arachnophobia, check. Outbreak, check. All right, got the names of the movies, guys. Good to go.
Won't get those wrong now.
Yeah. Araka. What was the name of this one? Araka?
Arachnophobia.
Araka break?
Oh, yeah. All right.
Phobia break. It's where all the phobias break out.
That's right.
Okay. All right. Let's do this.
It's on.